The assertion first recorded and transmitted by the Sumerians that man was created by the Nephilim appears at first sight to clash both with the theory of evolution and with Judeo-Christian tenets based on the Bible. But, in fact, the information contained in the Sumerian text, and only that information, can affirm both the validity of the theory of evolution and the truth of the biblical tale, and show that there really is no conflict at all between the two. The Sumerian text recorded instance after instance of events that had taken place when man had not yet been created, when Nippur was inhabited by the gods alone. At the same time, the text also described the creation of earth and the development of a plant and animal life on it, in terms that conform to the current evolutionary theories. All the Sumerian texts assert that the gods created man to do their work. Similarly, no sooner had the biblical deity, like the gods in the Sumerian accounts, created man, than he planted a garden and assigned man to work there. And the Lord God took the man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to tend it. In the Sumerian versions, the decision to create man was adopted by the gods and their assembly. Significantly, the book of Genesis, purportedly exalting the achievements of a sole deity, uses the plural Elohim, literally deities, to denote God, and reports an astonishing remark. And Elohim said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." Whom did the sole but plural deity address? And who were the us in whose plural image and plural likeness man was to be made? Condensing the many gods into a single supreme deity, the biblical tale is but an edited version of the Sumerian reports of the discussions in the assembly of the gods. Lacking only certain knowing and a divine span of life, the Adam of the Garden of Eden was in all other respects created in the image and likeness of his creator. The use of both terms in the text was meant to leave no doubt that man was similar to God, both physically and emotionally, externally and internally. But how indeed was man created? The Western world has long wedded to the notion that, created deliberately, man was put on earth to subdue it and to have dominion over all other creatures. Then in November 1859, an English naturalist by the name of Charles Darwin published a treatise called On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. Summing up nearly 30 years of research, the book added to earlier thoughts about natural evolution the concept of natural selection as a consequence of the struggle of all species, of plant and animal alike, for existence. Darwin's shattering bombshell was the conclusion that all living things, man included, were products of evolution. Man, contrary to the then-held belief, was not generated spontaneously. It seemed that the very words of the Old Testament were indefensible. For how could a God who has no corporal body and who is universally alone say, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness"? But are we really nothing more than naked apes? Is the monkey just an evolutionary arm's length away from us? Evolution can explain the general course of events that cause life and life's forms to develop on Earth, from the simplest one-cell creature to man. But evolution cannot account for the appearance of Homo sapiens, which happened virtually overnight in terms of the millions of years evolution requires. The scholars have no explanation, but we do. The Sumerian and Babylonian texts do. The Old Testament does. Homo sapiens, modern man, was brought about by the ancient gods. Here then is the answer to the puzzle. The Nephilim did not create man out of nothing. Rather, they took an existing creature and manipulated it to bind upon it the image of the gods. As the Nephilim looked about them, they saw not only the predominant mammals, but also the primates, among them the man-like apes. Is it not possible that the roaming bands of Homo erectus were lured to come close to observe the fiery objects rising to the sky? Is it not possible that the Nephilim observed, encountered, even captured some of those interesting primates? Faced with the need for manpower, resolved to obtain a primitive worker, the Nephilim saw a ready-made solution: to domesticate a suitable animal. If, as the ancient evidence and modern science seem to confirm, life on Earth germinated from life on the 12th planet, then evolution on Earth should have proceeded as it had on the 12th planet. Observing the various forms of life on Earth, the Nephilim and their chief scientist, Ea, needed little time to realize what had happened. During the celestial collision, their planet had seeded Earth with its life. Therefore, the being that was available was really akin to the Nephilim, though in a less evolved form. The process that Ea recommended in order to achieve a quick evolutionary advancement of Homo erectus was, we believe, genetic manipulation. We should assume that the Nephilim, being capable of space travel 450,000 years ago, were as equally advanced compared to us today in the field of life sciences. We should also assume that they were aware of the various alternatives by which two preselected sets of chromosomes could be combined to obtain a predetermined genetic results, and that whether the process was akin to cloning or cell fusion, genetic transplant, or methods as yet unknown to us, they knew these processes and could carry them out. Sumerian texts speak of deformed humans created by Enki and the Mother Goddess in the course of their efforts to fashion a perfect primitive worker. But finally, the perfect man was achieved, the one Enki named Adapa, the Bible Adam, our scholars Homo sapiens. With this final product, the Nephilim were genetically compatible with the daughters of man and able to marry them and have children by them. But such compatibility could exist only if man had developed from the same seed of life as the Nephilim. Man in the Mesopotamian concept, as the biblical one, was made of a mixture of a godly element, a god's blood or its essence, and the clay of earth. The second chapter of Genesis offers this version. And Yahweh fashioned the Adam of the clay of the soil, and he blew in his nostrils the breath of life, and the Adam turned into a living soul. Adam was used as the genetic model or mold for the creation of duplicates, and those duplicates were not only male, but male and female. The ancient legends and myths, biblical information, and modern science are also compatible in one more aspect. Like the findings of modern anthropologists, that man evolved and emerged in Southeast Africa, the Mesopotamian text suggests that the creation of man took place in the Apsu, the lower world, where the land of mines was located. One can even conclude from the various texts that the creation of man caused a rift among the gods. It would appear that at least at first the new primitive workers were confined to the land of mines. As a result, the Anunnaki, who were toiling in Sumer proper, were denied the benefits of the new manpower. Now, a puzzling text named by the scholars the Myth of the Pickaxe is in fact the record of the events whereby the Anunnaki, who stayed in Sumer under Enlil, obtained their fair share of the black-headed people. Grateful, the Anunnaki lost no time in putting them to work. The book of Genesis likewise conveys the information that the Adam was created somewhere west of Mesopotamia, then brought over eastward to work in the Garden of Eden. The only complete account of the events that befell man following his transportation to the abode of the gods in Mesopotamia is the biblical tale of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And the deity Yahweh commanded the Adam, saying, "Of every tree of the orchard eat you shall, but of the tree of knowing good and evil thou shalt not eat of it. For on the day thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die." An idyllic picture soon gave way to dramatic developments, which biblical scholars and theologians call the fall of man. And the serpent said unto the woman, "Nay, you will surely not die. It is that the deity doth know that on the day you eat thereof, your eyes will be opened, and you will be as the deity, knowing good and evil." And the woman saw that the tree was good to eat, and that it was lustful to behold, and the tree was desirable to make one wise. And she took of its fruit and did eat, and gave also to her mate with her, and he ate. And the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. One cannot seriously assume that the purpose of the whole incident, which led to the expulsion of the earthlings from the Garden of Eden, was a dramatic way to explain how man came to wear clothes. The wearing of clothes was merely an outward manifestation of the new knowing. The acquisition of such knowing, and the deity's attempts to deprive man of it, are the central themes of the events. Throughout the Old Testament, the term to know is used to denote sexual intercourse, mostly between a man and his spouse for the purpose of having children. The tale of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden is the story of a crucial step in man's development, the acquisition of the ability to procreate. That the first representatives of Homo sapiens were incapable of reproduction should not be surprising. Whatever method the Nephilim had used to infuse some of their genetic material into the biological makeup of the hominids they selected, the new being was a hybrid, a cross between two different if related species. Like a mule, such mammal hybrids are sterile. Were the Nephilim at first simply producing human mules to suit their requirements? After Enki managed to produce a perfect model, mass production techniques are described in the Sumerian text, the implanting of the genetically treated ova in a production line of birth goddesses with the advanced knowledge that half would produce males and half would produce females. Not only does this bespeak the technique by which the hybrid man was manufactured, it also implies that man could not procreate on his own. Was that what the god, the serpent, accomplished for mankind? We recall that in all ancient traditions, the chief deity fought a serpent adversary, a tale whose roots undoubtedly go back to Sumerian gods. The possibility that the biblical antagonist, the deity and the serpent, stood for Enlil and Enki seems to us entirely plausible. Their antagonism originated in the transfer to Enlil the command of Earth, although Enki had been the true pioneer. While Enlil stayed at the comfortable mission control center, Enki was set to organize the mining operations in the lower world. The mutiny of the Anunnaki was================================== directed